This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he's just doing what it takes to get his country jump-started after years of neglect and decline. And if that means shutting down independent news bureaus, clamping down on local governments, exiling his opposition, well, that's just the kind of house-cleaning Russia needs, he says. But is this old KGB Nick going too far in the name of cleaning up Russia? And is the U.S. too preoccupied with its war on terror to give its newfound Russian soulmate a real critical glance? I spoke with Andrew Jack earlier today about the closing of Moscow's TV6 network. He's the Moscow correspondent for the Financial Times. I asked him where this move leaves freedom of the press in Russia.
The first challenge isn't so much press freedom as diversity of press ownership. And the result of this, at least temporary, closure of TV6 means that all of the national television channels in Russia are now effectively in one form or another under the hands of the state. So it's not necessarily the case that we'll see, or we are already seeing, a complete clampdown on expression of different forms. But what it means is that there's some at least potential pressure for less criticism of the administration and the Russian authorities in the future.
How has the Russian press reacted to the closure of TV6?
The reaction has been varied. I think certainly much less reaction than there was last year when NTV, a much larger private media group, was taken effectively into state hands. And also a lot of ambivalence, just given that the owner of TV6, Boris Berezovsky, himself has a very patchy record, given his own considerable role in the election of Mr. Putin through the control of a television channel which was certainly not renowned for objective or independent reporting of politics in the past. So Berezovsky himself, a very controversial figure, and many people here do read the action against TV6 as being less about an attack on press freedom and more about President Putin removing some quite widely criticized and controversial figures from positions of influence.
Why have Putin and the public been so allergic to these oligarchs?
Well, clearly these are very controversial figures, emerged in rather shady circumstances, and suddenly by the mid-90s had become incredibly powerful, influential business figures controlling a large proportion of the Russian economy and having an enormous amount of political influence to the point of effectively writing their own laws or influencing regulation and competition policy, as well as holding an enormous influence over the press and therefore influencing public opinion and the amount of information that was getting out.
So this, in a way, gets to the bottom line, doesn't it? On the one hand, Putin is cleaning up a situation people are concerned about. On the other hand, in today's Russia, all national television broadcasting appears to be either fully controlled by the Kremlin or constrained by self-censorship.
That's right. Certainly, Mr. Putin's rhetoric, at least when he goes on foreign trips, is to stress his commitment to a free and independent media. And I think there's no doubt that the most safe guarantee of independent media in Russia is a series of newspapers, radio and television that are economically self-sufficient and therefore can afford to be critical of power as much as of any other vested business interest. The problem at the moment in Russia, like of course a number of other countries, is that clearly there aren't the financial means to create this degree of autonomy. Mm-hmm. And so any attacks that take place at the moment, even if not having freedom of speech as the main target, end up reducing diversity of ownership and therefore potential for criticism in reality.
Has there been much response from the Russian public to this closure?
There's been some very modest demonstrations, and some of the Russian media, particularly the more independent and critical newspapers and radio stations, have raised concerns, but much less controversy than last year.
The approval ratings of Putin are now running in the 70% to 80% range. That would appear to suggest that in spite of these moves that could be interpreted as clampdown, he's got fairly good public support.
That's right. It's too early to see any opinion polls since the latest TV6 action. But I do think a large proportion of the Russians believe that this is more about an attack on vested interests that don't have public support than it is about freedom of the press. And equally, sadly, for an awful lot of Russians, economic conditions, their own wages and pensions and salaries are much more important and pressing issues for them than more abstract concepts like freedom of expression or even political freedoms.
In a recent interview with the Polish media, Putin lamented the Russian people's, what he called their excessive dependence on the state. How does he think they'll get out of that without a vigorous independent press?
Publicly, again, Mr. Putin's rhetoric is that the two go hand in hand, but clearly there are models in the world, including in China or in certain parts of South America, where an authoritarian state has been accompanied by economic growth, at least in the short term. Mm-hmm. That's to take the most skeptical line. The most positive, certainly the more impressive achievements of the Putin administration in the last 2 years have been to try to liberalize the economy, to reduce individuals' dependence on the state, and try to create the conditions for foreign as well as domestic investments and economic growth that in itself can help Russia become more self-sustaining.
So it's a complex picture, but Andrew Jack, where you sit in Moscow, does it look to you as though it would be fair to say that closing TV6 is one more step toward greater authoritarianism?
I think it's certainly a step backwards in terms of democratic developments that were achieved during the 1990s in Russia, although it has to be seen as more complex than simply a deliberate blow against freedom of expression.
Andrew Jack is the Moscow correspondent for the Financial Times. President Bush said last summer, after his first meeting with Vladimir Putin, that he liked him, that he had a sense of his soul. Certainly, Putin's soul is complicated terrain for a Western democratic leader. On the one hand, Putin has pledged to clean up the corruption and graft that have dogged Russia for decades. On the other hand, his heavy-handed clampdowns on opponents in the media and politics have outsiders worried about how real his interest in democracy really is. Is America's new anti-terror soulmate taking Russia back to the authoritarian rule of USSR times? And should it matter to Americans whether Russia successfully transitions to democracy or not? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me in the studio tonight is Marshall Goldman. He's professor of Russian economics at Wellesley College and associate director of the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard University. Good evening and welcome, Marshall Goldman.
Thanks very much, Tom.
And joining us from Washington tonight is Anders Osland. He's co-director of the Carnegie Moscow Center's Project on Economics of the Post-Soviet States. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Good evening, Anders Osland.
Good evening.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Marshall Goldman, let's start with you. All right, here's this picture. What does it all mean? TV6 has been closed down. It's the last in a string of independent television broadcasters. There's a lot else that's going on. I guess to get right to the heart of the question, is Russia drifting back into authoritarianism? What's the evidence, and why does it matter?
Well, it matters, first of all, to us because we were hoping that Russia had turned that important corner after the collapse of communism and the breakup of the Soviet Union. And it's clear that it's nice to have a nice country there that's supporting the kinds of things we're interested in, not only in a battle against terrorism, but in the move towards democracy. And there have been signs of that. What's going on now? Well, in some respects, it's not purely black and white. Mm-hmm. But in some respects, what he's just done with TV6 is a continuation of this KGB-Nick type reaction. In other respects, he's done some good things. He's tried to simplify regulation in the economy, and he's tried to move the economy forward. But, you know, given his instincts, and it's not just his instincts, it's the fact that the people around him, the people he's bringing in, have the sense that here's a KGB man in charge. Many of his friends that he's brought in come from the KGB, mm-hmm. kind of giving them license to do what they want. And there have been lots of abuses that way, and that's what's scary.
But Russia in the 90s looked like such a mess. We all heard about the gangsterism, the crimes, the cronyism, yeah. the carving up of all the assets of the nation for a few people. Maybe it's time for some law and order. Does that mean despotism in Russia?
Well, it doesn't have to mean despotism. And to Putin's credit, he has cleaned some things up. But at the same time, while he's going out against some of the oligarchs that arose during the Yeltsin period, he's allowed a new bunch of oligarchs to come in and do more or less what they want. And that's the problem. One member of the Duma just put it this way, which reflects, I think, just what you've said. He said, under Yeltsin, We may have been slowly fumbling our way through a thick jungle,
but
at least it was in the right direction. Under Putin, we're building an autobahn, but it's headed the wrong way. Well, that's a little too strong, but it's certainly not going the way that we'd like it to go.
And just before we turn to Anders Aslan, if it's going the wrong way, where does that mean it's going, and what's the problem with the destination?
Well, the destination is that if you criticize Putin, you're going to be pushed out. That's clearly what is happening. And it's not just the TV networks, the national TV networks. You've got even greater problems in the provinces. And again, there's this sense that you don't criticize Putin, he just will steamroller over you.
And so, is it just an ideological conversation here, or does it mean that Russia will never find its feet somehow?
Well, it will find its feet. After all, it found its feet in the Soviet period, but it's not a footing that I think that we want to encourage or that we would like to see develop in that part of the world or serve as a model for other parts of the former Soviet Union.
Anders Aslan, we're so happy to have you tonight. Take us into this. It's a complex thicket. On the one hand, clearly Putin is making some progress. On the other hand, it's charged that it's coming at a price to freedoms in Russia that may get it off in a bad direction. What's your assessment?
Well, I think that it's important to understand what Putin is about. And in his speeches and in his actions, he has given us quite a clear idea of what his priorities are.
All right.
The first priority is radical market economic reform.
Mm-hmm.
Second priority, rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
And the third, that Russia is part of Europe and the West.
How's he doing
that? Which we've seen particularly strongly after September 11, while he's indifferent to democracy. But then you have a man, as you mentioned, who has approval ratings of around 75%. In addition, he has a parliamentary majority behind him. And his opponents today are the military, the police, and the security establishment and bureaucracy. If you have that situation, you need democracy in order to win. So this makes me more optimistic about the situation. And I think, as Andrew Jack pointed out, that this is primarily about Berezovsky and Gosinski.
These two oligarchs.
The two oligarchs who indeed pursued a fully fledged campaign with their television channels in 1997 in favor of corruption and against reform. And I don't think that Putin wants to risk that again. The means are not beautiful, of course, but I think that these two people do pose problems that any democratic society would have to face up to.
Do you see Putin as effectively now pulling Russia out of the chaos that dogged it in the 1990s? Is that happening?
I would say even that it has already happened. Russia has had an average economic growth of 6% for the last 3 years. What we are seeing in Russia is a full-fledged economic boom. And what's driving it now is economic reforms. And as Marshall said, Putin has undertaken very substantial economic reforms. And what we are seeing now is a strong new middle class being formed in Russia.
And what of the American, perhaps it's a stereotype, but that Russians have a predilection for authoritarian rule, and high approval ratings may simply mean that they're looking for a strong man in charge?
Well, I think that this is really just a prejudice. Putin is a very skillful opinion poll politician, like Gerhard Schröder or Bill Clinton, a person who reads the opinion polls every day, according to his pollsters. And whenever he doesn't have a strong view, he takes the view of a majority.
Marshall Goldman, just 30 seconds before the break, but is this just the way Russia has to be to get along?
I'm not sure. I don't think that has to be the case. There are other countries that have made reforms that haven't fallen back into some of these traps. Anders and I are old friends, but we disagree on a lot of things. And I wouldn't say it's not a question of rule of law. What I worry about here is dictatorship of the law, and that makes a big difference.
Rule of law or dictatorship, we're talking tonight about Russia and its president, Vladimir Putin, how he's leading that country. Anders Aslan says, has led the country out of the chaos of the 90s toward a brighter economic future. But what about the political future? And is this the right kind of ally for the United States to have in its war on terror? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back.
from Boston.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Vladimir Putin's Russia, ally of the United States, the White House, and George W. Bush. How do you feel about America's new global partner, Russia? Is Washington ignoring authoritarian backsliding in its new best friend? Is the West right or hypocritical in expecting democracy in Russia? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Marshall Goldman, professor of Russian economics at Wellesley College, and Anders Aslan, senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. Marshall Goldman, just before the break, Anders Aslan laid out his view that Putin has come in with a very clear agenda. He wants radical market economic reform. He wants the rule of law, and he wants Russia aligned with the West, that he's succeeding on all these fronts. And Anders Aslan makes the case that he's succeeding as a Democrat.
I don't agree. Certainly, there's been change. Certainly, and Anders is right, there has been economic growth, but that's been fueled largely in the past, up until this point at least, on the basis of the export of petroleum and natural gas. There have been some reforms, but it remains to be seen whether or not this economic growth will continue. I should point out that there were some, including Anders, who in 1997 said that the market had come to Russia, and then there was a collapse in 98. So I'm not prepared yet to say that this is the beginning of a full-fledged economic boom, as Anders said. And already there are signs that the growth is slowing down. But the thing that worries me in this point is that the dictatorship of the law, which is what Putin said he wanted to do, has led him to ignore the rule of law, which is certainly the case in what happened at TV6. And he's emasculated the upper house of the parliament. He basically, people who were elected, he said, okay, you're no longer there. You're no longer going to be able to have a voice. And brought
he
in
just
people.
Kicked them out? Was
he
that extra legal?
Absolutely. And he's put in new people. And now the Duma, the lower house, it's true, has been much more supportive of what he's doing, but in many ways it's become a rubber stamp. And that I don't want to go back to the obstructionist way the Communist Party was dominating the Duma before, but it certainly looks like a very thin democracy.
Anders Aslan, how about it? 2 points here, I guess. First of all, the evidence that this market reform and embrace is real beyond the energy market, which has brought petrodollars to Russia. And secondly, the evidence of real democracy on the ground.
Well, I think that the oil prices and the devaluation started the economic boom. But Russia has cut personal income taxes to a flat tax of 13%, which has had an obvious effect. The big problem we discussed in 98, it was a huge budget deficit done away with. Mm-hmm. It was big subsidies, as much as 16% of GDP, done away with. It was that most transactions were undertaken through barter, that is, with goods rather than money, and that has almost been done away with. So what we have seen are massive reforms, and to believe that these have no positive effects, that is to believe that it's not really important what a market economy looks like. We have to measure what's fair, and I'm sure that Marshall basically agrees on this point.
All right, credit due there. What about on the Democratic front? Marshall Goldman says the Duma upper house has been gutted beyond the scope of the law. Putin's just done it. What about it?
Yeah, I don't agree. Previously, you had an upper house consisting of the governors, and they were sitting there as regional representatives, exercising a veto on everything concerning them. And you don't have it in the U.S. Instead, Putin has organized a system which corresponds to the upper chamber in Germany, a country that he often looks for to as his ideal model. And, of course, that is an improvement. If you talk to democratic activists out in the regions, they very much appreciate Putin, because they see the main threat to democracy coming from the regional governors, who are often not at all very democratic. There's much more democracy at a federal level in Russia than at the regional level. But Putin has done a great deal to improve the very poor democracy at the regional level in Russia.
Anders Osland, I want to get under your skin a little bit. Look at this with us. Do you think that the West is nitpicking in sort of working Russia over on how precisely democratic it is? Is that beside the point right now? Is it hypocritical of the West to come in and say, here's our standard and we need you to live up to it? After all, it was only a few years ago we worried about Russia just coming apart at the seams and creating a vacuum of crime and debt and everything else. If Putin can get his act together, is the West wrong or hypocritical in nitpicking about democracy? How do you see it?
A bit both ways. I think it's very good that the West is very concerned about democracy in Russia. As Marshall Goldman emphasized, this is very important because without democracy, I don't think that Russia will develop very well. But indeed, it's nitpicking. If you look upon the television in Russia, the quality is excellent. The pluralism is extraordinary. And coming from Sweden, I'm used to state television. Mm-hmm. In Sweden, there are two state channels that are totally dominating the news. And then there are private channels that do little but entertainment. Mm-hmm. In Austria, there are two state channels that also politically control the news. So why do we not complain about Austria and Sweden in terms of democracy while we complain about Russia's television when Russia has much more pluralist and much better television than these countries? It doesn't quite make sense.
Marshall Goldman, how about it? Here we have a Russia that's a champion of the freedom of the press and Vladimir Putin, great Democrat.
You're taking two small countries, you know. Russia is a country of 146 million people. Austria and Sweden, two channels, that's probably a big deal for them. But, I mean, I want to complain about Austria and Sweden? Please be my guest. But the point is that in Russia, you should have much more. And clearly what has happened, the minute that you begin to criticize Putin, he begins to move indirectly one way or another. Look, let me just go back to one thing that Andres said when he talked about the fact that he's made improve the Council of Federation, the upper house, mm-hmm. the Senate, so to speak. I'm not challenging that. What I said was that he did it. He just simply issued a decree. I'm dissolving it, despite the fact that these people had been elected to that post. That seems to me to be ignoring the rule of law.
Mm. We're talking about...
Sorry, it was done through law.
It
was not done through a decree.
Anders, he didn't, you know, that nobody voted on it. The public didn't vote on it. It was part of the Constitution, and he just overrode it. It's that kind of thing that I'm concerned about.
We'll take that
the
point.
The election to the upper house is not clarified in the Constitution.
Anders Osland, we'll take that point as disputed. But the bigger question here, we're talking about Putin's Russia. Is Vladimir Putin pulling overdue order from chaos or bringing back the iron fist? Is America's security clampdown giving Moscow a green light to follow its own anti-democratic impulses? What do you think? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. A lot of people would like to do that. Let's bring them in. Yevgenia's on the line. Welcome, Yevgenia.
Hi. My name is Yevgenia Albots. I'm a Russian investigative journalist, and both your participants of your program know me.
We're happy to have you. Welcome.
I am just stunned by what I hear. I'm curious where Mr. Osland found... Plurist media now in the rush in mm-hmm. Russia.
You don't see pluralism.
I don't. I mean, we ceased to see any real pluralism after the first NTV station was gone.
The closing of NTV last summer. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and what happened now with the closing of the last non-government TV station? It's a real tragedy. The absolute majority of Russians have no access to newspapers just because they don't have money to buy them mm-hmm. and because newspapers don't have facilities and resources to deliver newspapers to the rural Russia. Therefore, people across Russia do get their news only and only through the TV station.
So, Yevgenia, you're a Russian journalist. You say they're not getting a mixed bag of free information now. What is the impact of this in your mind? What are the consequences for Russia?
There is a pure manipulation of the public opinion. And the reason why all this is happening is not because there are any liberalization of the economy. It's tremendous misunderstanding of the events. There is the process of redistribution of property mm-hmm. that is going on right now in Russia. The newcomers, people in Appalachia, those guys from the KGB, who came into power on all levels of the Russian authority.
Yes, what about them?
They're trying to grab what they lost back in August of 1991, when they lost their control rights back then, and now they're trying to grab it back.
You're saying they're grabbing political power or economic power?
Both. They're trying to, via the political power that they got over the last 2 years, they're trying to grab property rights.
Yevgeny, stand by. Anders Oslin, you hear an impassioned voice here saying, hey, there's not enough free press in Russia, and the old KGB bureaucrats are grabbing the pieces of the economic pie.
Oh, so I hear. Yeah, I read Yevgeny Albats continuously and with great appreciation. I mean, of course, this is a negative point, but still Russian media are very pluralist. Russia, Moscow today has about 20 daily newspapers of any shade of opinion. The internet media are vibrant with anything that you could not find in Western countries, because people would sue for libel. Vladimir Posner's program on ORT is widely considered the best program of a talk show. And I think that what I want to do here is to say that the situation is not as bad as it's presented. Of course, it's bad that private ownership is decreasing. It's not disappearing. In
Did you say private? Oh, in television, I see.
Yeah, there are still private television channels. On the KGB people trying to grab economic and political power, yes, I agree with Yevgeny Albats that this is the big worry. My interpretation of the situation, though, is that Putin has distanced himself significantly from these people since he came out in favor of the U.S. on September 24th. And it's most striking how little these people so far have got under Putin. I might be wrong on this, but it seems to me that they are not getting to what they want.
Yevgeny Alberts, let's hear from you for just another minute. Let me ask you, if you were sitting across from Vladimir Putin and he said, Yevgeny, settle down. I know it's not perfect, but we're making economic progress that's essential here. Just deal with it. What would your response be?
My response will be, how you are going to know whether you are making any economic progress or not, if there is no media to report about that? How do you know if those who are submitting news to you are trying to submit you only positive news so to please you, so to get the promotion? That's exactly what we had under the Soviet Union.
And what's happening?
Answering to what Dr. Arslan just said.
Yes.
If there is such a great pluralism, he said 20 dailies in Moscow, where you find them? But anyway, if there is such a great pluralism, why I am journalist with 24 years of experience with both Russian and foreign media, Neiman Fellow, Alfred Friendly Fellow, the one who got Golden Award in Russia, Golden Pen. Why I am unable to publish my columns in Russian?
Well, that's
why
not an easy question.
The only way for me is to publish it in English. You don't read me in Russian anymore.
That's a pretty tough question. Yevgeny Alberts, we're honored to have you as a listener and a caller. Thank you very much for calling in. Marshall Goldman, what do you hear here?
I agree with Yevgeny, but I want to just tell a joke, which I think reflects the current joke in Moscow, which reflects what's going on here. Putin is bringing all these people in from St. Petersburg and from the KGB. You have to understand that. And that's these people are the ones that are beginning to seize property. So the joke is, a man is walking in the street in Moscow. He's about to get on the train. Another man comes up to him, stamps on his foot, and holds his foot there. After 5 minutes, the guy whose foot is being hurt says, excuse me, can I ask you a question? And the guy hurting him says, yes. He says, tell me, are you from the KGB? And the man says, no. And he says, well, then tell me, are you from St. Petersburg? And the man says, no. So then he says, well, why are you standing on my foot? I mean, the implication.
Get your foot off my neck,
this
please.
Is a new group of people coming in. And I'd like to say that, for that matter, Putin came in with the help of Berezovsky. And indeed, we do see these things. And in the provinces, it's much worse. There is no pluralism.
Let's bring in another call. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
This is my first-time caller, and I listen to your program as often as I can.
It's great to have you.
Well, basically, the only thing that I have, only two comments. Basically, our democracies, every democracy in the whole world, is all an incremental approach. into all these problems. And Russia is no different than, we've been at this for 200 years. Russia has only started to evolve into a democracy. And it's going to take some time in regards to, you need to have some sort of dictatorship for a short period of time to so that all these things can evolve.
Hey, but John, didn't they have about a century of that? Wasn't that enough?
Well, no, basically, I mean, if you look at Russia, they don't have any sort of infrastructure as it is in regards to laws.
But, John, one of the things that's worrisome is that there did seem to be more democracy, more pluralism of the sort that Anders was talking about under Yeltsin than there is now. That's what's worrisome. It looks like this is a step backwards.
But we take your point, John. You're saying give them a break. They're going through a tough transition. Don't be too upset over transgressions.
Right. I mean, if you look at Machiavelli, I mean, he has to be Machiavellian about some things. You know, even our President Bush has done that sort of thing. Sometimes you have to be tough on some issues, even though it's against the grain of what it's really necessary to do. Sometimes you can't take a step.
Well, it's an interesting American voice you bring to this, John, and it's not the traditional line we expect to hear from America looking at Russia. Certainly wasn't during the Cold War. But Marshall Goldman, what do you hear in this? Is this just a case of the West applying standards that are unreasonable to Russia when it's trying to dig itself out of a deep hole? Or if we don't apply these standards, is Russia going to end up in some kind of bad place?
Well, it's certainly we're holding them to a very high standard. But I mean, but if they want to be considered a part of the West, and here I do agree with Anders that Putin wants to make Russia part of the West, then we expect them to follow the same kind of procedures and not try to cut corners along the way. If they don't hold up to those kind of standards, we deal with other countries. We're dealing with Pakistan now. You know, we've dealt with other countries where they short the sheet on the bed. And so we'll just have to get along. But again, this is an ideal, and I don't say we should pull our punches. Nobody's mentioned Chechnya, by the way. And, of course,
the dirty war. But now another front in the war on terror. So how can we complain?
Well, but we still can and we still should. I mean, this doesn't mean that we don't want Russian support. And they have things to criticize us legitimately about. I wouldn't argue about that for a second. But still, we should hold them out to that higher standard.
Anders Oslin, just a minute before the break, but should we give Russia the same kind of leeway that we've given Chile in the past, that we give China today? Is that the point? Here?
No, not really. I think that far too much leeway is given in particular to China, not to mention Saudi Arabia, which is one of the most repressive states going in the world. But the question is where you draw a line. Russia is now in a post-revolutionary stabilization, and then people are less concerned about democracy, which is a danger. Because it's vital that democracy survives. It's a huge investment that Russia has done, which China hasn't done. And we should honor Russia for that, and not only then complain when there is something little that Russia does not do. And that is effectively how the Western debate functions, complaining about everything that is bad and saying very little about all the good things that are being done.
Anders Oslin, stand by. We're talking about Vladimir Putin's Russia. Listeners, do you care if Russia is democratic or not? If Putin can get things done, do you care how he does it? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Vladimir Putin's Russia tonight. And the balance, if that's the right word, between tough love, maybe even extra legal love sometimes, and economic development. Is it the right balance? Is it a balance that the United States can put its weight behind, its friendship and support behind? We're joined tonight by Marshall Goldman, professor of Russian economics at Wellesley College, and by Anders Oslin, senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. Just before Christmas, December 24th, Putin went on live television in Russia to report to the nation. He said incomes were up by 6.6% in real terms. Average wages had increased by 21%. Unemployment was down. Birth rates were rising. Things were looking great. A caller asked him if on his recent trip to the United States, he had had any qualms about staying in the American president's home, the White House. And he said he hadn't been concerned. He said, quote, The current president of the United States is himself the son of a former director of the Central Intelligence Agency. That's why one can say we were in quite a family atmosphere and understood one another pretty well. Marshall Goldman, we're having a little fun with that, but is the United States giving a kind of signal to Russia right now that as long as it can fight terrorism, keep its house in order, and be a friend of the U.S. on the global stage, Washington doesn't really care how it does it, or is that too simple?
I think it's a little too simple, but certainly there are the signals there. And, in fairness to Putin, he was the first foreign leader to call President Bush after the September 11th attack, mm-hmm. and he's been quite supportive. And here Anders is right that Putin is doing these things despite the fact that many people in the military establishment are very upset with the fact that he's done this. He was just attacked by the head of the Communist Party, for example, for making Russia a colony, as it were, of the United States.
What about that? Anders also made a very strong point earlier in our conversation. He said, look, if the military, the police and security establishment are all against Putin, how can he not be a Democrat? Well, it seems like a fair question.
First of all, they're not all against him. Some, you know, there are some that are there, and these are hangovers from the past, but then some of the new people that he's brought in are former KGB people who I think owe their allegiance more to Putin than they do to anything else. But if I do admire Putin for standing up to this, and I give him credit. But again, the thing is he leans over backwards. And let me just go back to say one other thing that Evgeny Albats brought up that I think is important, and the extension of that. What difference does it make if Putin does intimidate the television? Well, what difference it does make is that you then can't point out Putin's shortcomings. And that, in part, helps to explain his very high public opinion standing. And I think that's important to understand. You've got to show the problems. That's what the free press is really kind of like the fourth estate. You need it for that purpose. And if you don't have it, you've lost something.
Anders Austin, we're going to come to you in just a minute, but we have a lot of callers. Let us bring some in. Hudson is on the line. Welcome, Hudson. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. You mentioned the parallels in the intelligence agency between Putin and Bush. I just want to build on that. If you look back at the series of bombings of apartment buildings in Russia, that obviously gave Putin the rationale to go after Chechnya and adopt a very hardline war on terrorism, mm-hmm, effectively. Mm-hmm. And it rehabilitated him politically, because leading up to that, he was risking or facing the prospect of losing the presidential election.
Okay, so where are you going with this, Hudson?
Well, similarly, looking at Bush, he was in a very difficult position politically, facing a commitment to a big tax reduction, promising not to touch Social Security, and was essentially saved by the acts of September 11th.
So what, we should support or criticize these two guys because they both had big bombings on their watch?
Well, I'm not implying anything sinister here. What I'm saying is that may be a reason why they understand each other, but also, perhaps more disturbingly, it shows in quite dramatic fashion how the political fortunes of these, mm-hmm, two leaders can be turned around. By
Hudson, thanks for your call. Certainly, they're both hinged at this moment off their critical responses to significant security threats. Anders Osland, how about that? Do you think that Russians are in part supportive of Vladimir Putin because he has dealt so forcefully with Chechnya? And does that make him a good ally of the United States in its war on terror?
Well, Tom, as Hudson said, it did make Putin's early popularity. Mm-hmm. But we should remember that there was also an open attack by Chechen militants under Shamil Basayev in Dagestan. Mm-hmm. And that was totally unrelated from the bombings. And that was really a sufficient reason for Russia to have to deal with Chechnya in that time. Mm-hmm. No country can accept full-fledged military interventions on its territory. But I think Putin was anyhow forced to undertake some action in this regard.
Let me jump to this
December 24th call-in program.
Yes.
I'm happy that you mentioned that, Tom, because that really shows that Putin is out for something. The U.S. president would never do something like this.
Bill Clinton did, but you mean just to actually appear on a call-in show and take calls on TV live?
2.5 hours and allowing massive criticism against whatever state authorities do. This is something you do if you want to start a serious attack on the administration.
I should say, in fairness,
I think that's what it's about.
In fairness, the report of that call-in show notes that his comments about the great increases in the Russian economy were followed by calls, one from a teacher in the Urals who said that her salary was comical, and the next from a World War II veteran demanding to know why she had to survive on a pension of 1,000 rubles, $33 a month. Marshall Goldman, the man of the people, is here.
Well, I give Putin credit for exposing himself for this. So there were a lot of criticisms along the way, and this pensioner that you just mentioned thereafter got a call from a local authority saying we're going to increase your pension. So to some extent, this did serve.
It pays to call.
It does pay to call. It does. It did serve a useful purpose. But again, you know, this is still kind of hinged with all kinds of the cult of the personality seems to be recurring. New books are just coming out talking about how wonderful this man is. And again, if you eliminate criticism, that's what's scary.
Let's take another call. Maya's on the line. Welcome, Maya. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you.
Sure.
I just wonder, always bothered about our chronic hypocrisy of somehow holding other people to a higher standard than we really hold ourselves. Freedom of the press has not been invented. It belongs to the person who owns the press or owns the power of the advertiser over the press or the station. I do think that if someone who owned a station or network was charged with serious crimes and fled the country, that the FCC would probably take their license away. I don't think that in this particular case it's, you know, not very different.
So you're saying if America had to deal with big press baron oligarchs like Russia had, the U.S. wouldn't like it either. But don't we have big press baron oligarchs in effect?
There's nothing very democratic about Rupert Murdoch owning media outlets in four countries.
And yet, but we put up with it. I mean, we give him the freedom of the press because we're open to the criticism.
Yeah, but let's not pretend it's democratic. I don't think that democratic control of the media has yet been invented. I don't know anyone who has it.
Maya, thanks for your call. Marshall Goldman, there is a thoroughly jaded American media consumer, and we understand in part why that's true, but isn't this cacophony of different voices what it's all supposed to be about?
Well, that's what I would agree 100%, and I think she's right. That, you know, I'm sometimes a little nervous about what goes on in this country under the guise of freedom of the press, but let me just correct one thing. She said, wouldn't we do something if these guys fled the country? Well, the reason they fled the country is that laws were used to go after them specifically while allowing friends of Putin to go about untrampled. And that's what, again, is so worrisome. And it, therefore, it becomes very peculiar. And the only reason these people were picked is because they were critical. Those who weren't were allowed to continue what they were doing.
Anders Osland, our time is running down, but give us your prescription. What should the United States do to be most supportive of getting and keeping Russia on the best track right now?
Very simple. Do you know that 80% of all Russian visa applications to the U.S. are refused, while only 4% of all Russia visa applications to the European Union are being refused?
Why is that? On what grounds?
Well, ask the State Department and the INS about
Give us a clue.
This is the very restrictive U.S. policy towards Russians visiting this country.
So your prescription is open up and embrace them, and I'm afraid we've got to cut it there because our time is...
Means that the elite, Russian elite, are very fed up by how they are being treated.
Well, let's invite them over for dinner. Anders Osland, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Anders Osland is Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And Marshall Goldman, thank you to you.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you, Anders.
Marshall Goldman is Professor of Russian Economics at Wellesley College. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. More than 4 months after September's terrorist attacks, many Americans still feel that they have yet to return to a comfortable, normal life. Independent producer Laura Tanguso spoke with people at a bowling alley in Dorchester, Massachusetts, and found that fear and uncertainty still lingers.
Hello, my name is Gloria, and in relationship to what had happened in September 11, my life has been totally changed. No, things are not back to normal for me. I'm a Christian. I find now that I'm going to morning prayer more. I used to pray almost exclusively for my family, but now I'm praying for others. I'm more cognizant of my neighborhood, my nation. I'm praying for the president. I never prayed for anyone in authority. I just think, you know, there's a whole different dimension of me that I never thought of. Before, I was more of a type A, mostly a workaholic and so on. Now I'm slowing down. I'm enjoying my daughter, my husband, my granddaughter. I'm out bowling right now. I really, you know, just feel that it sort of made me step back and reflect on what's most important, and family's very important.
Maurice Rickard. I work for the MBTA. I drive the trains. You got to be more aware of the people that's getting on and off. Be aware of the things that are around you, things people leave on the car, things people leave in the station. Sometimes people leave bags. You never know what's in the bag, and just got to be more careful.
My name is Mark Woodley, and I live in Hyde Park, Boston. And I think that the problem that happened on September 11th really changed the things that happens in our school. And there's more, like, security. They're more cautious. My mother and father are real cautious now with me. They always want to know what I'm doing and where I'm at. And I don't have that much freedom anymore to do what I want.
My name is Bob. I'm a salesman, and sales are pretty slow the last couple months, and looks like the economy is going back down too. So what happened on September 11th was, you know, unbelievable. And I think it affects everybody somewhere, you know what I mean? Because of I'm a salesman, and in my last couple of months, I've been just truthfully watching where I spend my money and, you know, doing trips instead of going on vacations, you know, do a road trip instead of usually we go somewhere, I think Vegas or something like that. But this year, I think we're just going to watch and see what happens in the next 6 months and see how the economy goes. And, you know, hopefully there's no more tax or anything like that around here. My 401k has been down 20% too, so working harder. And I'm off tomorrow at work, and I'm going to work. Because things are so slow as far as my dollar revenue that I have to work on days. And I've been going out Saturdays and Sundays sometimes too. So stop buying, people. Stop buying. You know?
My name is Myra. I'm still worried, not for myself, for the children, because every night I pray and I thank God that none of my family was affected. I have 5 children, and, you know, I worry about them because I really don't want to go without saying goodbye. And a lot of parents didn't get a chance to say goodbye to their children. You know, my Christmas was very sad. It was that thought behind my head that a lot of children was without no parents, a lot of husband was no wife, you know, there was a lot of pain. This was the worst Christmas, I think, for the entire world. Because even though when I went shopping for Christmas, I didn't feel the joy, you know, in the community. You could see around the neighborhood, there was not so many lights. You know, like decoration, Christmas decoration. You didn't see all that spirit that we all feel during Christmas time. It's a wound that we all carrying, and it's going to take time to heal.
Voices from a bowling alley in Dorchester, Massachusetts. If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is special@wbur.org. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you.